Capital Investment, Third Capital Investment Committee will come to order. We have a sparse audience and a little sparse membership, but we have new chairs. And so we're just happy today because the chairs have arrived and they don't creak and they don't fall. And we're not going to tip over. In our excitement, we might jump up, but I don't suggest that that happen either. Let us proceed. We'll go right to the agenda, and let us start with the report from Ramsey County. Thank you, former representative and commissioner, Ms. McGuire.
Yes. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members. I really appreciate you taking me early in the agenda, and I know you have a busy day ahead of you, and I have a board meeting at 9, so I really appreciate you taking me ahead of time. And as Madam Chair, as Madam Chair said, I have served in those seats, and I really appreciate all the work that you're doing. I am Mary Jo McGuire, and I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner, which, as you, to remind you, is the county that we're in. We're the smallest county in geographic size, and the second highest in population. So we have worked hard on a lot of bonding projects with the bonding committee and with the state of Minnesota. And I'm just going to talk to you a little bit about the impact that they've had on our region and our state. So first of all, one of the major areas that you've been a great partner with us is in the area of transit. And you've been helpful in helping us with the Green Line, which is the line, the transit line that goes between Minneapolis and St. Paul, and then in helping fund a part of the Union Depot. That was a lot of federal and state money and local money. And the Union Depot is now a hub. We were able to keep Amtrak here to keep that going, and that is part of that hub. Then also we're working on a high-speed train between here and Chicago. It's also the hub for other transit lines, the Riverview Corridor, which is going to go from downtown St. Paul to the airport, the Gold Line, which is going to go along 94 East, and then the Rush Line, which is going down from St. Paul to White Bear. So these are just some transit lines that we have been able to do that have really helped with economic development in our region. It's really helped us be a center where businesses want to locate, because we know that transit is a big issue for the people that they want to hire, and so we're very grateful to the state for their partnership in that. You also were a partner on the 694 and Rice Street, which was also an economic development tool for us. We had St. Jude Medical there, and they needed an interchange there that would help with all their employees, and you were helpful in that. Also, in road projects at our largest Superfund site that we cleaned up out at Rice Creek Commons, or the former TCAP area, which is being developed now, and you helped us with some road projects there. So I also want to talk about how helpful the bonding committee has been in helping with some recreation projects. I'm going to talk about a project now that was not a Ramsey County project, but it was a Roseville project, and it was an issue that I carried. It was an issue that was started by my predecessor, John Rose, who was a Republican, and then I came in, and we made it a bipartisan. I succeeded him. And we made it a bipartisan bill by getting a speed skating rink in Roseville. And it is one of the largest sheets of ice in the upper Midwest and in almost all of North America. Kids were going to have to be practicing in different places. Milwaukee has a similar sheet, but nothing in this area. So all of our kids were able to now speed skate. They play hockey there. We figure skate there and bandy. And I know that we've had some future Olympians are training there, and we've had people that have been on Olympic starter teams from there. In the interest of recreational opportunities, I know currently we're going to have a project of a winter recreation area at Battle Creek that you're going to be seeing as a proposal, because we know that recreational opportunities are really important for the region and for the people. We have no opportunity to cross country ski these days with the lack of snow in the eastern metropolitan area. So our cross-country skiers have to travel to the West Metro, sometimes 1.5 hours one way, to get to snowmaking. So we're going to be asking for some ability to build up our recreation area, our winter recreation area, so that we can have our families and our skiers and our kids have a great lifelong activity in winter recreation at Battle Creek. So just thank you for all of your work. This year, I know that you're going to be listening to lots of proposals. We look forward to sharing more with you, some of the things that we've got going. And I just want to mention, I know, Madam Chair, you asked for things pre-2000, and I know that we also have Landmark Center that Ramsey County has, and some of you have been to this beautiful facility, and you've helped with some of those dollars more recently on that, too. So just want to say thank you for all of the work that you've done. Everything that you've done has been regional in impact and really has impacted residents from all of your districts, I'm sure. But thank you again, Madam Chair, for letting me come and present to you the great benefit that this committee does. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Commissioner, and drive safely to the next 9 o'clock meeting.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And members, in your packet is the minutes of the previous meeting, and I'm sure Representative Sanson's moved that they be adopted as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. The next report that we're going to hear is Joel Carlson. Who's going to tell us how to pronounce his project, the project that he says from the 20th century makes such a difference on the 21st. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you. My first regret of the young 2019 session is that taxes meets at the same time as your committee, so I don't get to hear all the stories because I have some work that I need to do over there as well. But thank you for having us here today. You know, a significant project for me and impactful for me was the construction of the Moorhead Sports Center that my parents led in 1974. And having played a lifetime of hockey in that building, that's probably had more impact on me personally. But the most significant project that I had the chance to work on was in 1985 and 86, and Chair Murphy actually helped me. For those of you who don't know, I spent a brief tenure here as a member in the early 80s, and I've caught a 35-year tailwind that has carried me here to where I am today. But the Heritage Yomkamps Interpretive Center in Moorhead was a project that I was able to carry as a legislator, and this project was the brainchild and inspiration of one of our guidance counselors when I was in high school. Robert Ast had an idea of building a replica Viking ship and sailing it to the motherland in Norway. And it was built in a barn outside of Moorhead in Holly, Minnesota, which he converted into the Holly Shipyard. Now, no ship has ever been built in Holly except this one. And it took him about 10 years to build this ship. And kids would come out and work on it during the summer. We kind of lived the building of this ship. I graduated from high school in 1978. And the Yomkamps made its maiden voyage in 1980. And this was a time of great pride in Minnesota and around the country, the Miracle on Ice. And now we were built. This was a really a big deal. And so they put the ship in Duluth in 1980. And Robert Asp died of leukemia 4 years later, or 4 months later. In 1982, his four children, three sons and a daughter, along with a crew of eight, sailed the Yomcoms across the Atlantic, through the Great Lakes, across the Atlantic, to Bergen, Norway, and then on to Oslo. And it was an awesome story. It received daily updates and attention. And Morehead made a commitment to bring that ship back and make it a centerpiece of their heritage, and that was the birth of the Heritage Yomcoms Interpretive Center. So in 1985 and 86, the legislature saw fit to invest half of the money in the Interpretive Center. The rest of it was raised locally. It was about $1 million. You've since put in additional money into that facility. I think in 2005 there was $1 million of upgrades to the facility and bank stabilization. But this is a project that has really, been one of the things that has made Morehead and the Red River Valley a richly woven tapestry of unique aspects, and it's been great. And I've always been thankful for the legislature for doing it. And that is one of just a few of the dozens and dozens of projects I've had the pleasure of working on. I serve on the Amateur Sports Commission with Representative Lilly, and we've constructed hockey rinks and soccer fields and things that are important to all kinds of communities. And I've worked with Bud Nornes on the redevelopment of the Regional Treatment Center in Fergus Falls, which was constructed in 1895. Can you imagine the legislature investing in a million-square-foot facility in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, in 1895 to house over 3,000 people with physical and mental disabilities, a staff of 4,000 people, their own farm, their own power generation? That's the things that Minnesota was doing in the early 1900s. And to see and work with Bud to redevelop that facility and preserve that facility for the community and for the state's history has been really fun to work on. I'm working on a project right now. Nothing has probably been more transformational for the Twin Cities than the construction of the lock and down system through Minneapolis and St. Paul for commercial navigation on the Mississippi River. That was constructed in 1937 and now has been decommissioned to prevent the spread of Asian carp up the Mississippi River. We're working on a project now to repurpose that as an educational and water-related educational facility, and that's a fun project. So all of the work that you do in this committee is important and significant, and I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to come and remind you of it and look forward to doing more of it in the future. So thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. And we still see on Channel 8, public television, the boat sailing out, going over to Bergen.
It has, that replica ship has been of great interest across the globe, and there have been many documentaries made of the shipbuilding and the voyage, and it is really a uniquely Minnesotan story. So.
It is. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Aaron Harfenberg and Mr. Liddy.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Erin Hannifenberg. I'm with the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. And Chuck Liddy and I just wanted to highlight a few more historic preservation projects that the state has invested in over the years and really highlight the importance of that. And looking at the speakers and hearing so far from the things that they've they've had to share with you. It's apparent to us how much heritage and culture and history have to do with Minnesota's identity and how important the state's investment is in retaining those things and helping them see a future. So we're really grateful for the support that the state has given to these kinds of projects. Obviously, from year to year, there's typically some funds that go towards state-owned properties that are of historic nature, things that are owned and operated by the Minnesota Historical Society, historic buildings at the university campus, for example. But I wanted to highlight a few of the projects that are local projects that are also rehabilitated or restored through the state capital grants and aid, which is a program that a grants program that the Minnesota Historical Society has administered over the years. These are the kinds of funds that have restored barns and depots and courthouses and city halls and libraries, things that are historic and aging structures in communities, but that really, really are significant to those local communities. And through this grants program, they're able to secure additional funding and do the necessary repairs and restoration work that these buildings require. There's also been direct bond appropriations towards things like the Pickwick Mill in Winona, which is, you know, a small but really, really historically valuable mill that is privately operated. And one of the projects that I was most inspired by and is a little bit more recent, but the Rock Island Swing Bridge in Invergrove Heights was a private toll bridge that was train traffic on the top level, cars on the lower deck. It was built in the 1880s, and it was closed in 1980 to train traffic, and then closed entirely to vehicle traffic in 1999. So in 2009, the bridge was slated for demolition. It spanned the Mississippi River, and it had been locked in its open position for 10 years to allow barge traffic to go. We called attention to the importance of the bridge in 2009, and a group of AP history students at Simley High School got involved. They researched the bridge. They interviewed people in the community who had some familiarity with the bridge, who had crossed it back in its heyday, and they ultimately decided to advocate for the bridge here at the Capitol. So they had contacted the governor, and they asked for there to be a moratorium on the demolition of this bridge. And then ultimately, this committee appropriated $100,000 in the bonding bill in 2009 that then leveraged $1.3 million in federal stimulus funding. So now the bridge has been what's remaining of the bridge. The swing span has been removed, but the rest of it has been rehabilitated. It serves as a pier that extends out from the shore in Invergrove Heights, and it's a really great linchpin in this economic and parkland redevelopment right there along the river. So I think that's a really great example of how a pretty modest investment by the state can leverage additional funding and really have a meaningful impact for a local community.
Mr. Liddy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. Aaron had to find somebody that was old enough to remember some of the impacts that heritage preservation projects have had going back into the 80s, and she found me. I'm a principal emeritus at Miller Dunwoody Architects in Minneapolis, and I'm former HBC chair in Minneapolis. I'm the vice chair of the Historical Society State Review Board and former board member of the Preservation Alliance and Preserve Minneapolis. I've personally done over 250 historic preservation projects, and I'm here to highlight two of the ones that our firm and or I have been associated with over the last almost 40 years. Miller Dunwoody started working on the Minnesota State Capitol in 1976, and from or 1975, and from 75 to 2005, we had over 80 individual commission numbers assigned to the projects. Everything from the Rathskeller to handicapped accessibility to infrastructure upgrades, the House and Senate Chamber, the initial remodelings back in the 80s. Over $60 million was spent in that 30-year period that stabilized and kept the Capitol functioning up until you were able to finally do the work that was done a couple years ago. The work that we did always had to be done off-session, so every project had to be done between basically June 1st and January 1st. And so it was always small amounts rather than $330 million. The other project that I'm currently working on that has a huge impact in the state of Minnesota is Fort Snelling. In particular, I've been working on the Upper Post. Again, Miller Dunwoody started working at Fort Snelling in the 1970s, did the restoration and reconstruction of the officers' quarters and the commandant's house, among other things. I started working at Fort Snelling in the 1980s on a number of projects, and at the Upper Post, which is the area south of the freeway where the ball fields are, closest to the airport. I started working there in the 1998. Since 2006, we've worked with Hennepin County and the DNR to stabilize and rehabilitate the buildings and keep them standing, anticipating a reuse that could come along eventually. In 2008, the legislature granted $500,000 in bonding funds, and again in 2010, another $1.2 million. That money was used to secure the buildings, re-roof with slate the hospital building, which is the largest one out there. It was used to help teach sentenced to service crews to repoint two of the buildings and stabilize them. Three had partially collapsed. One of them finally completely collapsed, but the other two were reconstructed and saved. So the efforts that the bonding, and I've given probably, I don't know, three or four different tours to legislators out there over the last 10 years. The money that was spent was able to be leveraged towards about $8 million worth of stabilization work that took place, and now $100 million worth of rehabilitation that Dominion is undertaking to take the 26 existing buildings and turn them into workforce housing with family and veteran preference. So it's a tremendous opportunity for you to be able to, you know, you don't have to give money for everything all at once. Very often you can give a little bit and help stabilize things so greater things can happen in the future. One thing I think is important is not including the historic fort, which is called the Lower Post. Approximately 30 buildings at the Upper Post, dating from the 1870s to the 1930s, are going to be rehabilitated for reuse. Some of them have been empty for 50 years. While one building built in the 1980s is going to have to be torn down in order to make room for the rehabilitation taking place where the visitor center is going to be. So not to disparage newer buildings, because I work on those too, but there's buildings from the 1870s to the 1930s that are all being rehabbed and going to be reused, and a building from the 1980s that has to be torn down. So,
laying the foundation, huh, Mr. Liddy?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Udall.
Thank you, Mr. Liddy. I was just wondering what the cost of all you're talking about for the Fort Snelling project is.
The total cost for the current proposal?
Yes.
Is about $100 million. It's 180 units of housing that'll be spread across 26 buildings, ranging from single family housing to the hospital's the largest building. I don't know how many units there's going to be finally in that one. There's going to like 20 units in the band building and in the officers or the infantry barracks buildings, which are the big ones closest to the airport.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Udall.
Mr. Liddy. This is separate from the historic fort and visitor center.
That's correct.
Project.
Yeah, that's being rehabilitated separately under a different bonding program through the historical society.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Lee, I'm sure that you will, when the time comes, you will be invited back to the committee to tell us about that program in detail. I would like to continue with the agenda. Melissa Lesh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're talking about projects in the 20th century that were funded in part with state investment money to build the 20th century into what it became and to set the future for the 21st century. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Good morning. My name is Melissa Lesh, and I am the Senior Government Relations Representative for the City of Minneapolis. The city greatly appreciates the opportunity to be before you today. I'd like to begin by thanking Representative Dean and Representative Lee for sharing the city's appreciation for projects more recently funded by state bonds in the city of Minneapolis, such as the redevelopment of Nicollet Mall, the Upper Harbor Terminal, and the creation of the new Guthrie Theater. I would also add Orchestra Hall to that list of very special recent projects. In thinking about these shared cultural spaces, in your discussion last week, Representative Dean also highlighted the Chatfield Center for the Arts, and is also struck by the comments of Representative Lehman and Chair Murphy regarding the Miles Reiff Performing Arts Center and the performance exchanges that occur between dancers in Grand Rapids and the city of Minneapolis. Your discussion of connectivity is deeply significant, and that theme and a theme that we certainly carry when we consider what projects to bring forward for your consideration. Your discussion made me think about connectivity as it relates to two very different projects in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Convention Center and the preservation of the historic Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery. In 1998, the state partnered with the city of Minneapolis to jointly finance the expansion of the Minneapolis Convention Center. The original center was solely financed by various city taxes authorized by the state, but city taxpayers simply could not carry the entire burden of the costs of the needed expansion. The state stepped in as a partner and financed $87 million in bonds for the $250 million project. In that same year, the state recognized the vitality of such gathering places around Minnesota. The St. Paul River Center, Duluth Convention Center expansion, Fergus Falls Convention Center, and Rochester's Mayo Civic Center were all funded together in the 1998 bonding bill. These projects together represent a recognition of Minnesotans' needs to come together in celebration, in common cause, in community, and in commerce. These centers around Minnesota are almost misnamed as convention centers, as they really have become our community's central gathering points to participate in our shared experience as Minnesotans. As such, these convention centers also serve as a reflection of our shared values. Now, as Minnesotans, one of those shared values is that we don't like to brag. But it's important for the committee to know the depth and breadth of the success of this crucial state-local partnership. Since 1998, the Minneapolis Convention Center has hosted over 25 million attendees with over 14,000 events. This has generated an estimated economic impact of over $5 billion and direct revenue of over $350 million. The Convention Center sustains 8,000 hospitality jobs on an annual basis. The Minneapolis Convention Center also hosts a wide variety of local, regional, national, and international events, most of which I'm sure many on the committee have participated in, such as the boat show, the auto show, the RV and camping show, the home and garden show, and the sports show. Corporate clients include Target, Best Buy, 3M, United Health Group, and General Mills. International events have included two Super Bowls, the NCAA Final Four, the Republican National Convention, and hundreds of association and trade shows. In 2018, for example, we hosted the Society for Mining, Metallurgy, and Exploration with 5,000 attendees, National Education Association with 16,000, American Legion with 10,000 attendees, National Baptist Convention with 15,000, and Society for Women Engineers with 6,000 attendees. And proudly, the building is also LEED and Green Meeting Industry Council certified. The Minneapolis Convention Center represents an opportunity for large-scale, modern connectivity. The projects for which Minneapolis seeks state partnership are sometimes large, like the Convention Center, but they are often smaller, and even more significance to our culture and history as Minnesotans. Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery is one such project. For those of you not familiar with the project, Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery is in South Minneapolis at 29th and Cedar. A National Historic Landmark, Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery was originally established in 1853. It is the oldest surviving cemetery in Minneapolis and the final resting place for over 20,000 individuals. Pioneers is the only cemetery in Minnesota listed as an individual landmark on the National Registry of Historic Places. In 1928, the city of Minneapolis took over ownership due to the cemetery's poor condition, and has continued to manage the property with the help of countless historians, volunteers, and neighbors ever since. Pioneers is the only, there are two aspects of the cemetery that I'd like to briefly highlight that demonstrate how special this space really is. First, unlike other cemeteries of its day, Pioneers and Soldiers was never segregated. Its rich history of ethnic and religious diversity reflects the true cross-section of Minnesotans whose efforts contributed to our state's early development. Native Americans, waves of immigrants, early settlers, and African Americans are all buried here together. Second, as reflected in its name, thousands of Pioneers and Soldiers of Minnesota are buried in this cemetery. Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery contains graves of soldiers from the War of 1812, the Civil War, and the Spanish-American War. Reflecting the difficulty of this time, of the 20,000 individuals buried here, an estimated 60% are infants or children under the age of 10. Many were lost due to contaminated drinking water and communicable diseases of the day. In 2017, Chair Erdahl's committee included the remaining $1.09 million needed to rehabilitate the historic fence surrounding the property to ensure this treasure of Minnesota history is preserved for generations to come. So thank you for that. Finally, I would like to echo Representative Dean and Representative Leaves' thanks to Chair Erdahl and Chair Torkelson for their support for funding the needed rehabilitation of the 10th Avenue Bridge, a vital connector between downtown Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. And while I appreciate that the tour of the 10th Avenue Bridge had such a significant impact on Representative Lilly, I can assure the committee it was not our intent to leave the entire committee precariously perched atop a deteriorating bridge. We only meant to leave Representative Lilly up there. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and I look forward to working with you throughout the session.
Thank you very much. Ms. Haberger and Ms. Hedstrom, Lake Superior Zoological Society.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Lynn Haberger. I'm the Director of Business Operations at the Lake Superior Zoo.
And I'm Haley Hedstrom. I'm the Director of Marketing and Development at the Lake Superior Zoo.
And we're here this morning just to highlight a few of the very important and significant projects that state financing and state bonding money has helped the zoo grow. The zoo only began in 1923 with this one small deer in a pen, and the vision grew from there. A West Duluth businessman found a deer, put it in a pen, hence the Duluth Zoo.
Nice.
Right? Duluth really wanted it too. So over the years, there have been a lot of changes, a lot of growth that they weathered through the Depression. We have some beautiful historic buildings on what was the Duluth Zoo property, now the Lake Superior Zoo, the 1930s WPA buildings. One housed Bessie the Elephant. We've got some beautiful rock work done in our bear grottos and bridges across Kingsbury Creek that runs right through the center of the zoo. As the years progressed and we got into the 20th century here, the State Capital Investment Committee found us worthy to do several things as the paradigm shifted from animals in cages to natural and enriching habitats and empathy for animals, and a lot of your dollars helped us do that with some of the following projects. We did a snow leopard exhibit in 1993. A new Australian building was completed in 1989. Naturalistic habitats for the bears and cougars were completed in 1988. Transformation of that elephant house that I mentioned into a new Polar Shores exhibit was completed in 1990. To provide habitats for harbor seals, river otters, snowy owls, Arctic fox, and the famous polar bears, Bubba and Berlin. The Primate Conservation Center was completed in 1998 to house endangered primates that are part of the AZA Species Survival Plan. The Lake Superior Zoo is an AZA-accredited zoo, one of only 10% in the entire United States. Minnesota is fortunate that all three of their zoos here in Minnesota have attained and remain AZA accredited. That is a high, high honor. And lastly, at the very last part of the 20th century, the state helped us in building the new state-of-the-art animal care center named after Willard Munger, former state representative, senator from Duluth, to provide the best veterinary care for our zoo animals. So as you can see, the state has played a significant role in helping the zoo to remain vital and to help us do our mission.
So speaking of Polar Shores, the bonding request last year is the first significant that the zoo has received, first significant funds that the zoo has received since the flood of 2012 devastated our zoo nearly 7 years ago. This zoo was not only was not a recipient of any FEMA funds following the flood, nor any Minnesota flood recovery funds, or even any insurance proceeds. So we lost operating revenue, visitorship, membership, and our most popular exhibits, which housed Berlin at the time she was moved, as well as the other animals. So we will be transforming, now thanks to the state funds, this into a brown bear exhibit while adding back a few old favorites from the original shores, like river otters. And we're really excited that this northern Minnesota treasure that serves our community as a place for educational opportunities and conservation education to saving species in our region and around the world.
So thank you very much for the important part you've played in helping Duluth maintain a wonderful cultural and heritage area for our citizens and for the region.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What is state bonding? That's the next segment of our planned agenda. And state bonding isn't easy, but there will be no quiz. But we need to know it before we proceed much further along, and the different kinds of bonds we need to know about, so that we can explain it to our constituents when they want money, cash. Bonds work much better. Ms. Dyson, Mr. Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. In your packets, there's a photocopy of the slides that would have been on a PowerPoint but are not this morning, so it's just paper, but there are three per sheet, and that's roughly the outline that we're going to follow. And for the record, I'm Deb Dyson from House Research. Madam Chair, what are bonds? The simplest explanation is that they are debt securities issued by governmental entities, states, cities, counties, and they are issued to finance capital projects such as buildings, roads, or sewer systems, and to fund day-to-day obligations. That's the broad definition, and when the entity that is issuing the bonds, what they're doing is agreeing to pay the people who purchase the bonds, the bondholders, the principal, but also interest. So it's an investment for the people who buy the bonds. Bonds are described in a lot of different ways. Sometimes they're described based on who's issuing them, as state bonds or local bonds. Sometimes it's the purpose, transportation bonds or sewer bonds. Sometimes they're described based on the source of payment. And in this committee, you'll hear mostly about general obligation bonds, but there are also bonds that are called revenue bonds that are payable from revenues of the project financed with the debt that's issued. Sometimes they're described based on the maturity structure, the price, tax status, taxable or tax exempt. And for the purpose of this committee, the vast majority of bonds that we're talking about are issued as tax exempt bonds. And then sometimes the rate or the term. For state general obligation bonds, there are three sources of authority that we're talking about. First is the state constitution. In Article 11, Sections 4 and 5, That's where the authority for issuing state general obligation bonds is found. There is nothing in the Constitution that talks about revenue bonds or, as we'll talk about in a bit, appropriation bonds. The Constitution does not address those, but it does address general obligation bonds. There are Minnesota statutes, and then there's also federal law that relates to the tax status of the bonds. Going directly to state general obligation bonds, the state constitution governs the state's authority to issue the general obligation bonds, and the first is that all bonds have to be for public purpose. They have to be authorized in the state constitution, and there is a limited list of what general obligation bonds can be used for. The bonds have to be in the law that's authorizing the issuance of the debt. The law has to specify the purposes. So it's either going to be a statutory program that lays out how the bond proceeds will be used, or it will say exactly what the project is, where it's located. And then also, I think as the Assistant Commissioner Hasmer mentioned last week, bonds mature in no more than 20 years. The other thing is that bond authorizations, the law that authorizes them has to originate in the House. And this goes to the fact that the Constitution provides, when we talk about general obligation bonds, what we're talking about is the state guaranteeing the full faith and credit of the state to repay those bonds. And in general, the state statutes provide for a general fund appropriation, and in the law authorizing the bonds, there is a cap on how much money is transferred from the general fund to the debt service fund to pay those bonds. But if for some reason there's not a transfer of money or something, the money's not appropriated to pay from the general fund, the Constitution provides that there will be an unlimited statewide property tax that will be levied to pay those bonds. That is the full faith and credit of the state. Those bonds will be paid. That is not true for other types of bonds, but the general obligation bonds, that's what full faith and credit is talking about. That's what leads the bond council to say that a bill authorizing the issuance of bonds must originate in the House, because it's possible that a court could determine that it's a bill to raise revenue. And in the state constitution, a bill to raise revenue has to originate in the House. We don't have specific court guidance on that, but bond council advises that bonding bills with general obligation bond authorizations must originate in the House.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you. Just to this point about origination, there have been occasions where the other body has tried to do something a little bit fancy by picking up a House bill that is a House bill and somewhat related to bonding, and try to originate a bonding bill in the on the other side of the street. It's something that we defended against in the past, and I would just like to remind members and the chair that those folks on the other side of the street can be a little bit sneaky once in a while, and we should be very cautious about protecting our authority to start this bill in the House. I know you didn't know that, Madam Chair.
I can't believe.
It was on for the behalf of the freshmen that I
really appreciate that, and they do too, I think. Tell me about this property tax thing again. The statewide property tax, and then that would go into the state coffer to pay back this bonds.
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, that statewide property tax has never been used to pay back bonds, but that is the guarantee in the Constitution and in state statute to repay general obligation bonds. Since bonds have been issued, there has been the general fund appropriation to pay debt service.
Do you think Representative Marquardt knows about that? I'll have to ask. That's huge. But they're going to see that the state is not carrying the debt, right?
Sorry?
It's a good idea for a guarantee, but if we've never had to use it, we have pretty good policies that support what we're doing. That's my conclusion anyway. Please continue.
Madam Chair and the members of the committee, going on to the next page, this is where we're getting into what this committee typically is dealing with, which is the provision in the state constitution that it authorizes bonds to be used to acquire and better public land and buildings. The we're talking about capital projects, and it's capital in the sense of the constitution, not an accounting capital alone, because you can have capital equipment, but the constitution is not talking about equipment. It's talking about improvements to land and buildings and acquisition of projects related to that. The projects have to be publicly owned. The Constitution does not say what publicly owned means, but the Bonds Council's interpretation and advice on that is it has to be owned by the state or a political subdivision of the state. And that means that there are projects that we might think of as publicly owned, but they're such as the projects for Indian tribes, and those are not deemed public because those are, the Bond Council looks at it, those are sovereign nations separate from the state. So on the other hand, this Historical Society, even though it is a nonprofit organization, has been a state entity for so long that Bond Council deems it equivalent to a public state entity. So a lot of, as you will hear throughout this, a lot of what goes on in bonding is dependent on Bond Council's advice, and that's the primary source of our guidance on this. The other thing about the provision in the Constitution that is the bulk of what the bonding committee handles requires a three-fifths vote of both the House and the Senate of the law authorizing the issuance of bonds for those projects to acquire and better public land and buildings. There are other provisions in the Constitution that can use general obligation bonds that would not require that, including transportation bonds. The trunk highway bonds do not require that.
And the three-fifths vote is 81 and?
41. I believe that's right. Anyway,
thank you.
I actually don't pay as much attention to the vote required in the Senate, Madam Chair.
Somehow, I don't either.
Going to the next slide, this is where there is a list of other constitutionally authorized uses of general obligation bonds. And I don't know, in the type, it might be too small to see it, but actually in your packets, I believe there's also a publication from the office that, let's see, what does it look like? Oh, it's this one, Madam Chair. It says capital investment in state bonding. And there's more detail about all of these in this publication. But the other constitutionally authorized uses of GO bonds include repelling or suppressing insurrection. That was enacted back in 1857. To borrow temporarily through certificates of indebtedness. That was in 1962, which is the same time when the general purpose, various purpose, general obligation bonding to acquire and better lands and buildings was enacted. So use of public debt for bonding in Minnesota only goes back to 1962. There's the ability to refund outstanding bonds to establish and maintain highways, and that's subject to some other constitutional limitations in another article of the Constitution. This goes back to the Good Highways or Good Roads movement of the 1920s. There's to promote forestation and prevent and abate forest fires, construct and improve and operate airports and other air navigation facilities. That goes back to 1944. There's to develop the state's agricultural resources by extending credit on real estate. This is where the RFA programs that the state issues bonds for go to. Improving and rehabilitating public or private railroad rights of way. And then there may be other purposes authorized in the Constitution. What it says is, and as otherwise authorized in the Constitution. So let's see. Moving along, the There are other ways to pay for capital projects besides general obligation bonds. There's the general fund. The bonding bill often includes a cash appropriation for certain projects that either it suits the project better or perhaps it's not eligible for bond funding. Revenue bonds, as I said earlier, those are not specified in the Constitution, but revenue bonds are issued by the state for various purposes. And the sole limitation there primarily is you have to have revenue from the project to pay for those bonds. And then going to the next one, appropriation bonds. You heard some about that with Mr. Lee's presentation. The revenue bonds and the appropriation bonds, probably the most recent example of that was how those interacted was in the 2011 tobacco securitization. Those were actually revenue bonds. It was the revenue stream from the tobacco settlement that was paying the debt service on those bonds. And in the law authorizing that was a provision for what they call an extraordinary redemption of the revenue bonds with appropriation bonds after a court case was brought to determine the constitutionality of appropriation bonds. And the case was brought, the court said appropriation bonds are not obligations within the meaning of the Constitution, and so they could be issued, and they were to refund the revenue bonds that had been issued back by tobacco payments. And those appropriation bonds helped pay off debt service on outstanding general obligation bonds at that time. Appropriation bonds have been used since then for a number of purposes, and including the University of Minnesota Stadium. Those are agency appropriation bonds, but the debt state is paying the debt service. The University of Minnesota's biomedical research facilities, the housing infrastructure bonds, these are bonds issued by those agencies, but the debt service is coming from the state. Viking Stadium involves appropriation bonds, and then most recently, last session, the authorization of appropriation bonds issued by the state payable from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, which is pending. The state has been sued, and so those bonds have not been issued, and they cannot be issued until that is resolved. Other sources of funding for capital projects include lease purchase financing for equipment. That would require specific authorization, but it has been done. The lease purchase financing for real estate and credit enhancement programs.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was on the previous slide on to promote forestation and prevent and abate forest fires. Is that when was the last time we used that for bonding? I think we've had some forests for the future, but I'm not sure if that came out of bonding. And does that allow, and I've looked at that provision, does it allow for reforestation? For example, if taking down elm trees and or taking down ash trees and replacing them with new trees, can we bond for that?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, the state has used bonds for forestation, and I would have to go back and look at some information on it, but I believe there has been use of bond funds for urban forestation, the replacement of elm trees. It has to be on public property. It can't be private trees, but along boulevards, I believe that I can't remember what in the recent past.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, the City of St. Paul in 2017 received, I think, about $1.5 million in GO bonds for removal and replacement of ash trees on public rights of way.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lee, that was only the City of St. Paul, so no other communities received that money.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I believe I'd have to double check, but in the early 2000s, there were a few appropriations for the DNR to administer grants to local units of government for specific to, I think it was elm trees at that time. But there's a little bit of history. Usually it's dollar amounts in the $1 to $2 million range.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. The slide on other capital funding, as a newcomer to the Capital Investment Committee, I'm just interested in general fund and revenue bonds. So as a Capital Investment Committee, can you kind of give me an example of, if we have a number of projects in front of us, and some of them have the potential to generate revenue, is that a decision that the investment committee makes that, well, we have X amount that we can provide in general fund appropriations? You know, maybe this is a good project. It has the potential to generate revenue. Maybe we should do a revenue bond. Can you just give me some examples of when we would be making that decision?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, by revenue for the purposes of bonding, it has to be a revenue that comes from a source other than a tax of statewide application. As soon as you're talking about tax revenues, you're into general obligation bonds. So when you say revenue, if it is fee revenue, that has a possibility, but it's something that has to be looked at very carefully to determine what is the actual revenue that you're talking about. And whether or not it's within this committee, that is a decision of the chair and leadership and others. That's a legislative determination of where things like that are handled. An example in the past of revenue bonds would be the, I want to call them the 911 bonds. There are fees assessed for 911 services, and those go to pay bonds that have been issued by the state.
Madam Chair, and Ms. Dyson, so would that have been a project that would come before this committee, a revenue bond project?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, I don't believe it did. I think the Public Safety Committee saw it, but I could be wrong. I don't have a I'm trying to think of examples of revenue bonds that might have come before this committee specifically, and it's not coming to my mind right away.
Okay. So, Madam Chair and Ms. Dyson, so is it a fair assumption to say that primarily we're dealing with GO bonds?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Lehman, yes. Mentioned, the bulk of the work of this committee is in dealing with general obligation bonds, capital projects within that scope. I think the House rules also talk about any kind of capital project funding can be within the scope of this committee, but again, that is always, you know, a determination of others than myself. Did you want to add anything?
Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, kind of an example that comes to mind that isn't a straight revenue bond, but it is similar that the Capital Investment Committee has dealt with in the past. I can think of an example. So the parking ramp that abuts the Department of Transportation building, that was a GO bond appropriation that is financed by parking fees by users. So it's sort of a hybrid where it's not just the revenue from parking fees that pay back the debt service for that project, but it is fee revenue that comes into the general fund and essentially refunds the general fund for issuing debt on this structure that generates fee revenue. The MinSCU has sort of a similar feature where when the state issues debt for Minnesota state projects, a third of the debt service cost of those projects that isn't asset preservation comes from minuscule sources, so tuition or private donations or things like that. So there's sort of a hybrid approach where if there's some revenue, but it's not necessarily enough to cover all the cost of the debt service, then it'll be a GO bond that is supported by a revenue stream from fees or other sources that that actually in my presentation we'll get into a little bit.
And the rural finance authority.
Yeah, another example that Ms. Dyson reminded me is the Rural Finance Authority that does low-interest loans to farmers.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dyson, the difference in the costs involved with appropriation bonds as opposed to general obligation bonds, will that be covered later, or do you want to cover it now?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, there is a difference. Appropriation bonds are going to be more expensive because there's a greater risk to the investors than general obligation bonds, which also gets at why sometimes general obligation bonds are used for projects that might have some fee revenue. There is a lower cost to the state, but as to details of how much of a difference, I was not planning. I don't have the information for that, and I don't know if Mr. Lee was going to cover that or not.
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, there certainly can be a difference in terms of cost because, as Ms. Dyson said, GO bonds have the full faith and credit of the state, meaning that if the state doesn't appropriate debt service for whatever reason, there will be a statewide property tax to make good on the payments for those general obligation bonds. It says usually in the authorizing law for appropriation bonds that this is explicitly not the full faith and credit of the state. So you would think that all things being equal, investors would see that as a higher risk. A lot depends on the market in which bonds are being sold. One example is when the state went to market for selling bonds to build the Senate office building. I think that got an interest rate around I think about 3.7%. I'll have to double check on that. But that was a relatively low interest rate considering there was no appropriation for the debt service in law when the bonds went to market. That was appropriation was made in the subsequent legislative session. So a lot depends on the market environment in which bonds are being sold. Another piece of the cost of appropriation bonds versus GO bonds is that GO bonds have to mature within 20 years. So that means that the state's paying less in interest than, say, a 30-year bond where the state is having to make interest payments for much longer. There have been appropriation bonds in the past that have been 30 years, meaning that the state is paying a smaller price every year for that debt service, but over the life of the bonds, it'll be paid more than it would have had the bonds been issued as GO.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on the issue in front of us with the LCCMR appropriation bonds, I think the LCCMR has debt service in their bill like $8 million. So the reality is, unless we went to the market, we wouldn't know the exact amount of the additional cost. Is that correct?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, that's correct. I think you could ask MMB the same question of what is the dollar difference, and they say they wouldn't know until there's bidders on the product.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lee, I think Commissioner Franz was asked the question, if we did correct the bill, if we swapped general obligation bonding for the appropriation bonding, that he could go to the market right away. We could have a bond sale. I think he said that on the record. And those projects could start quickly if we passed and signed into law the general obligation bond option.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen,
Mr. Lee.
I think Ms. Dyson would want to answer that, actually.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, this is my understanding, it's not that the GO bond sale could take place immediately because the state does not sell bonds when the legislature is in session. There are too many uncertainties that can happen during a legislative session that might affect what has to be disclosed in the bond sale statement. The difference and why projects might be able to proceed right away, if a bill that converted trust fund bonds, appropriation bonds to GO bonds happened during early part of session, for example, the projects then would be authorized, and the state statute allows the general fund to front the money so that a project can get money right away and proceed. But the bonds wouldn't be sold until later, and the statute then says that once the bonds are sold, the bond proceeds would refund the general fund. So there's this mechanism for allowing a project to get money while the legislature is in session. So it's not that the bonds get sold. With appropriation bonds, there is no such mechanism. So there's no money until the bonds are sold for appropriation bonds. Does that answer the question? Okay.
Please continue.
Okay.
Page three.
I'm sorry, what? Cancellations. The state statute provides for cancellation of bonds and projects that are not proceeding, and it's a four-year opening. So January 1st of each year, the Minnesota Management and Budget will provide a report to the legislature on authorizations that are more than 4 years old for appropriations that are unencumbered, unspent for projects that aren't proceeding. It is not to cancel, you know, money that is still needed and is encumbered, but so a project might take longer than 4 years, but if nothing's happening in 4 years, it'll end up in the report. And what the report does then is it effectively freezes everything. The legislature can always say, no, we really want that one to stay open and reauthorize it, or from an accounting point of view, MNB prefers that it be canceled and then a new appropriation put into the system. That's a mechanical accounting issue, not a legal issue. But that's the cancellation statute. So unlike general fund appropriations in other bills, this cancellation statute applies to bond proceed appropriations, general fund appropriations, and appropriation bond proceeds. Anything that's in that capital investment bill, there's a provision in the first part of the bill that says this is the cancellation statute that applies. So it's 4 years. Various other topics that I won't go into too much. There's discussion of these in that publication that I mentioned that's in your packets. First one, the bullet point says no reimbursement. This is related to federal tax law for the tax-exempt status of the bonds, and basically project. What you want to be telling your constituents and those coming to you for projects is that if they've already begun work on this and spending money on a project, it's not eligible for the tax-exempt general obligation bonds. What they need to wait, and there are two reasons. One is the federal tax status of the bonds, and the other is that you want to make sure, especially if you're dealing with a grant agreement to a political subdivision, that what they're spending the money on is actually what the grant agreement will say. So you want a grant agreement in place and that the law has already been enacted. So basically no reimbursement. If somebody is looking at something like that, they really need to be talking to MMB staff to work through whether or not it's possible. The role of bond counsel. You've heard me mention bond counsel advice a number of times. Bond counsel is very important in all of this because we don't, as I said, we don't have a lot of guidance from the courts on what the Constitution provides for general obligation bonding. What we have is bond counsel advice. And the reason that's important is that to sell bonds in the market, you have to have a legal opinion saying, yes, it's all good and well under law, and without that good opinion, people aren't going to buy the bonds. And that's so bond counsel opinion counts for a whole lot. Bond counsel for the state is the attorney general, and then they hire outside counsel for work, especially on tax matters, but both outside counsel and the attorney general's office our bond counsel for the state.
Ms. Dyson, is there a face to the bond counsel? Is there one person or four persons or?
Madam Chair, I have not met the current bond counsel person. I understand it is the firm of Kutak Rock out of Omaha, Nebraska. They have a Minneapolis office, but I do not know the individual. Yes, Madam Chair, it typically will be an individual.
Maybe we should ask the Attorney General's office to send us a picture of the bond counsel. So if we meet him in the tunnel, we could say, good morning, Mr. Bond Counsel, or Ms. Bond Counsel. Are most bond counsels men? Are bond counsels women? Are they equally in gender? Is it a gender job, or is it a not?
Madam Chair, I would hope it is not.
I would.
I do not have knowledge.
I think we've got to find these pictures of these, or these. Maybe bond counsel should come to committee. Say, I'm bond counsel. I have a report to give. Maybe we'll work on that. Please continue.
Madam Chair, another topic is the use of state bond finance property. It becomes most important, I think, in working with local governments that are working with nonprofits to run the programs in the facilities, and sometimes local governments and the nonprofits do not really understand the obligations that they are getting into by accepting bond proceeds for the facility. Bond finance property remains bond finance property for a long time, and the restrictions remain in place for a long time. It used to be forever. About 10 years ago, there was a revisiting of what does it mean to be publicly, and this relates to it being publicly owned property. What does it mean to be publicly owned? And it was the severity of that interpretation was mitigated some, and it became that it is has to remain publicly owned property for at least 125% of the estimated useful life of the improvements paid for with the bond proceeds. So I think it's important for anybody that is working with local governments and especially with nonprofits that are hoping to operate the programs in their facilities, that they understand the obligations and the restrictions that are going to come with getting the money. And I believe that when there's a planned committee hearing on topics like this from MMB, and they can go into this further, but it is not the life of the bonds. It's not when bonds are repaid that matters. So, you know, bonds are good for, are sold, and they can be out there for up to 20 years. Once the bonds are repaid, that doesn't mean that everybody's free and clear now and can use the property the way they want. They're still restricted. So,
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Dyson. So, for instance, if a building has a typical use of 50 years and, you know, the bonds are taken care of in that 20-year period, what then becomes the obligation of the owners then and operators of those buildings? Is it to, you know, make sure that that building remains in similar use for what might be, 65? I'm trying to do math in my head. 65 years, or can that use change? Or when you say that the obligation of the bond is in force or in place for 125 years, 125% of the useful life of the property, I guess I'm trying to understand in my head what that actually means.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, that's a really good question, because what MMB and Bond Council have used for interpreting this, they go to the generally accepted accounting principles. And I remember when this was started, when they first came out with this 125% of the estimated useful life, I said, how does that apply to land? What's the estimated useful life of land acquired? And apparently, under those principles, and I'm hoping that MMB will address this more when they next come in to talk about this. It's 37.5 years. But in terms of the estimated useful life of the improvements, those are good questions. The most important message I'm trying to get across is that it's not that, you know, once 20 years has passed, the nonprofit that has been under a short-term agreement with the unit of government that owns the property to run a program that they can then take over ownership. They can't. It's not 20 years. It's not the – it's a different measure of when it can be deemed no longer state-owned or state-bond-financed property. Short of that, the way to get out from under state bond finance property restrictions is a determination by the granting agency and MMB that the property is no longer needed for the purposes for which bonds were sold and appropriated, and then the property sold. And the proceeds, there's a map in the statute of, you know, how the proceeds are allocated, but basically the state gets back its money. And so there's it's the general message I want to get across is this is not a simple fiscal agent situation. There have been some assistant commissioners in the past that really don't like the use of the word fiscal agent when you're talking about bond financing because of this this different relationship with the use of the property.
Representative South.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dyson, I'm interested in the duties issue of whether the bonds are paid off or not and that sort of thing, but you have this extended period of that. So is it the transaction of the property that's restricted and or is your normal care and those kinds of things that come with an owner's responsibility once they get ownership of a property? And that deals with both land and buildings and that sort of stuff. So I'm curious how it gets exercised. And then I was interested in your last statement that the state can post it, can determine this is no longer in use relative to the bonds that supported the purchase of it, and then the state gets its money back. That was an interesting set of words. I was curious, is it marketed, a market determination of what its value is at that point then, and that becomes the value the state gets back? So I know that that's a weird set of questions, and I don't mean to elongate the meeting here, but and we could talk later if you think that would be more useful.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Stock, the sale of the property, it is a fair market value assessment and the sale proceeds are what they're going to be at sale. To answer your question about the maintenance of the property, the issues that will come back to this committee relate more to if somebody owns there's property, it's being used for one a particular purpose, and then the purpose, somebody wants to change the purpose of the property and use it for something else, typically they have to come back here and get authority to change the use of the property. That's I know that the committee in the past has seen legislation like that authorizing a change in use, a change in ownership, something as simple as going from owned by the city to owned by the EDA. That might require legislation. But in all of these changes that might happen after something has been appropriated money, it's working through the details with MMB and Bond Council. Madam Chair, just to continue briefly on this, another bullet point about the non-state match requirements. Typically, first I'll say there is both a Bond Council's requirement and a state statute that says that bond proceeds are available for a project when full funding to complete the project as described in the appropriation is available for the project. And that applies across the board. They, as Bond Council, the former bond counsel from Dorsey & Whitney once said to me, we don't build half a building. You have to have enough money to finish the building.
Yeah.
And so that's part of, part of meeting constitutional requirements for it. The other, the non-state match requirement often comes up in the context of grants to political subdivisions, where there is a requirement expressly stated to that the local government has to come up with a certain amount. It might be 25%, it might be 75%, it might be 50%. Some of the statutory programs for, like, trails, trail connections, the statute says 25%. So it'll depend on, you know, what you're dealing with. But there's typically a match requirement, and the rider language needs to spell that out in the bill. And then the last thing I wanted to cover, particularly the I won't go into it in great detail, but I know that some members, having come out of local government, will say, well, at the city we were able to do X, Y, and Z. Why can't the state, for example, use geo bonds for equipment? There are differences between state and local bonding. The state is restricted by the state constitution. Local governments are restricted by state statute, and the state statute authorizes local governments to do things that the state can't do. So I just wanted to mention that. And I think at this point I will skip over the rest of this because some of it has already been carried, and I know that Mr. Lee has some material that he wanted to cover. So.
Mr. Lee?
Madam Chair and members, I'll just skip to the second to last slide because Assistant Commissioner Hasmer covered the debt management guidelines. But I'll just share with you a few of the spreadsheets that kind of demonstrate the committee accounts. So if you were to look at the MMB general fund statement of all the spending in the state, the areas that this committee has jurisdiction over is the debt service for the GO bonds, debt service for appropriation bonds, and cash spending for capital projects. And sort of the best way to see that is in your packet, there's a few spreadsheets. This one is the spreadsheet showing the bonding bill from last year, from last session. So that's chapter 214. So this summarizes all the appropriations that were made in that bill. I think if you remember from the first committee meeting, there was that long spreadsheet that showed the bonding appropriations going back to 2000. This is just what 1 year looks like. So just a few notes as you're looking at this. You can see the project, the fund type, as we were talking about earlier, most of the appropriations in the bonding bill are GO bonds, so you'll see under fund all that GO. And then you can see for Minnesota State, a number of those projects are both GO and user finance. That's what UF stands for. And I try to highlight wherever there's non-GO projects. So you can see on line 35, school safety grants, that's a general fund at $35 million, or $25 million, excuse me. And on line 39, the War Road School District, the Northwest Angle School, got $600,000. So you'd see there's a few different funds. Kind of another area to draw your attention to is on page 4. You can see the Minnesota Department of Transportation. This is where there were appropriations for geo bonding, a type of geo bonding called transportation fund, which is essentially a distinction without a difference. It's general fund backed debt for transportation projects for local governments. The Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Fund, and then some trunk highway bonding that you see in THB. Then jumping to the totals. Actually, before I get to the totals, you can see on page 8, starting on line 285, these are appropriation bond authorizations. They usually occur in another article of the bonding bill, so they're separated out in the spreadsheet. So this is appropriation bonds for MHFA for nonprofit housing. But then kind of a note on how to read the totals. So There's a few different GO bond categories. You can see on the top on 292. Then 293 is that transportation fund that I mentioned. That's still GO-backed debt. And also GO-backed debt is 295, the maximum school effort loans. And you can see the grand total of all the bonding authorization in that bill was about $1.43 billion. But then if you peel that back and take off the general fund, take off the trunk highway bonding, take off the appropriation bonds, and then there were a few cancellations. So if you look at line 311, the net GO impact, the net new bonds authorized after you account for what was canceled, was $825 million. I won't get into the next parts of the spreadsheet. That was the appropriations for the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, which is not typically carried in the bonding bill, except to note the appropriation bonds authorized off of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund are shown on page 11. Starting on line 410, and they total about $98 million. And as mentioned earlier, the debt service to cover those is shown on line 405. Kind of an odd note on that, since the lawsuit delayed the bond sale of those appropriation bonds, this authorized maximum debt service, the $2.94 million, hasn't been paid in fiscal 19 because the bonds haven't been sold yet. So,
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Lee, so line 405, if there was a correction swapping out to general obligation bonds, then that 2.94 million then would be go to the bottom line of the LCCMR, correct? Available for appropriation, or would it go? Where would it go?
Mr. Lee,
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I'll have to double check, but I would imagine that would be the case because it can be appropriated for debt service. So,
4 minutes left.
All right. Madam Chair, very briefly, I'll just go through the tracking sheet. It looks like this. It's just one page. So if this is the list of projects that the state is buying, this is the cost of that purchase, essentially, and the purchase of several previous bonding bills. On the first few lines are the appropriations for debt service for appropriation bonds. So you can see line 3 through 8 are all the various appropriation bonds. And typically those are 20 to 30 year life bonds payments. You can see on line 9 the $41 million. This was the general fund cash spending authorized in the last bonding bill. And then on line 13, you can see the cost of servicing the general obligation debt. Sometimes I get as a question, if you look on line 13, you can see that over the biennium, the total cost of GO bond debt service is about $1.1 billion for the two-year biennium. That isn't that more than bonds issued in a biennium, and that's correct. That supports about $4.4 billion worth of GO bonds. But, you know, because we are getting the projects sooner and having to pay interest, there sort of is a situation that in some years we are paying more in debt service than we are essentially taking out in bonds. Lastly, I have this legal size sheet. I won't go into this in too much detail, but this just gives you a visualization of the different components of state debt and the total principal outstanding. So this is a debt service. This is the total amount of debt that's remaining. So you can see the largest single category is the GO debt at about $4.2 billion, and then trunk highway bonds, and this is paid for out of the Trunk Highway Fund and those constitutionally dedicated taxes. Then a few general obligation, or sorry, not general obligation, but general fund-backed appropriation bonds. So you can see the two University of Minnesota, one's the TCF Bank Stadium and Biosciences, the 2011 appropriation refunding bonds. That's the piece of the tobacco bonds, professional football stadium, MHFA, and a few smaller miscellaneous items. And I'll just note on these smaller items, the largest being the new legislative office building, then the DHS and health buildings, and the egg building. These are the payments for these projects aren't in this tracking sheet. They're not necessarily within the Capital Investment Committee's budget. They do impact the guidelines, however. But they are baked into the appropriations for the various agencies or the Senate. So, with that, Madam Chair, I'm done if there's any questions.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your handouts and your advice and your presentations. And we will continue on Thursday with a tutorial for local units of government and political subdivisions as they navigate the complexities of submitting a request for bonding. And so that will help many members also, because they're being approached by people that say, can you get me a bonding bill on $30 million for something? And it's not quite that ready, or it's not quite that easy, but we're going to learn about it together, and we're going to finish the report. Yes, Representative Sanson.
Thank you. Just a question on the agenda on Thursday. Do we have any confirmation whether that will be televised?
Not yet.
Okay. I do have local governments asking for that request, just as an FYI.
So we will pass that on to Mr. LaGrave. Representative Salk.
And I just, Ms. Chair, I'd like to underline that because I think that there's a huge number of people that could benefit from understanding a one of explanations so that they're getting a single picture of it. And so if it's taped, it would be easy then for me to send that to Rochester or to any of the other small towns in my area so that if they want to contemplate this morass of things that they've got to work through, this would be a great place for them to get to know that.
We will take that under consideration, yes, and we will hope. Nevertheless, we always have the tape record. Thank you very much. We really appreciate it. Thank all of you for coming, getting here on time. Well, sort of. We also have in the packets the new, fresh publication from House Research on capital investment and state bonding, January 2019. Deborah Dyson. Read it. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.